This is All Saints Day, and it is a day when we remember those who have died in the past year, but also it is a way of remembering the church triumphant in heaven, and remembering that that we are surrounded by a great cloud of witnesses who are cheering us on, that we might remain faithful as they have remained faithful. And when somebody dies, we often will talk in the funeral service about what it means when a Christian dies. But I want to help us think, what does it mean when a Christian lives after he dies or she dies? And that means talking about heaven. When you ask people if they believe in heaven, most people say, oh yeah, I believe in it. Some 80, 90, sometimes as high as 95% people say they believe in a heaven. But they are almost always asked that as part of a poll that is done from your living room or on the phone in your house. Or maybe in the mall, somebody will come up to you and ask you a bunch of questions, and one of them might involve, do you believe in heaven? And almost everybody does. But it's hard to really know whether they really believe. Because from your home, it's easy to say, I believe in heaven. It's a very different thing to say, I believe in heaven, after your spouse has died. Or when someone you love has been told they have terminal cancer. One of the glories of being a pastor is being with people when they find out bad news, deathly news. Another glory of being a pastor is being with people when they are approaching death, like Everett Morrow, and hearing him say, I'm okay. I know where I'm going to be. I trust Jesus. I believe in heaven. That is a great comfort to me as a pastor, to see people in that situation. Because all of us, you know, if we're taking a vote, I'm hoping we're getting close to 99%. But what about when our life is on the line? Do we believe it then? As Christians, we want to be ready for that day and be able to say, I trust, when our life is on the line. Why do we believe in heaven? Well, the easy thing is to say because it's in the Bible, because Jesus says he goes to prepare a place for us. That's good enough for me. But it's also true that in this life, as we encounter life, the ups and downs of life, we often find ourselves dissatisfied, and we find that we have longings that are not being fulfilled. I have a longing to eat every few hours, but there's food. But what about those longings that are never fulfilled in this world? C.S. Lewis says there is good reason to believe that they will then be fulfilled in another world. In another place. When we think of heaven, we often want to know what it's like. And to be honest with you, the Bible doesn't say a lot about it. When you look at the early passages, it sometimes even seems as though they don't believe in it. In the early passages of the Bible, it seems like people just die and it's over. But as God revealed his will and his ways more fully, we began to believe, and now firmly believe, that there is a world beyond this world. There is a heaven. But it's not described, and we're not told much about it. But what we are told about it is in Revelation 21 and 22. That's where we get the pearly gates. That's where we get the streets of gold. We're not reading all of that in our passage today, but we're looking at that section. Remember that Revelation is written to seven struggling churches. You know, when you and I think of the church triumphant, we think of billions of people. But in the towards the end of the first century of the church, they were thinking in terms of thousands. The church wasn't great and glorious and big, and it hadn't gone on for centuries like we've experienced. And so John is giving the words of these prophecies, the words, some of which we're going to look at today, as encouragement and hope, that they might remain faithful and that they might remain hopeful in the face of persecution. And in some ways he says it's going to get worse before it gets better. That doesn't sound very hopeful. But when we get a glimpse of what he says, when we get a glimpse of the big picture of what he says, and as he shows us what lies before us, I think you'll find hope and strength. John begins by telling us what he saw. Then I saw a new heaven and a new earth. For the first heaven and the first earth had passed away, and the sea was no more. And I saw the holy city, the new Jerusalem, coming down out of heaven from God, prepared as a bride, adorned for her husband. John says that this world is going to be renewed, redeemed, that the old world is going to pass away, and this world is going to be redeemed. One of the confusing parts of the Bible and heaven is that there seems to be two places. One is where most people have gone when they die and go to heaven as believers, they go to heaven to be with God. But that's not the final resting place, because in our story, heaven comes down to earth, and this earth is renewed, and this world is renewed, and we don't just believe in the immortality of the soul, but in the resurrection of the body. And that God is making a new heaven and a new earth, a redeemed heaven, and heaven and earth is just a way of saying everything. It all gets redone and remade so that it is new and whole and healed. That's what he means when he says he sees a new heaven and a new earth coming down out of heaven. And it's called the holy city, the new Jerusalem. Jerusalem, as you know, is not particularly a holy city. There's been a lot of fighting and a lot of anger there throughout its history. But it was the place of the temple. And it was the place where Jews, ancient and modern, say heaven and earth meet. And that holy city is coming to earth. Heaven is coming down to earth. And it is described as a bride prepared for her husband. When I got married, I was 32 years old. You know how excited 32-year-old men are to get married? And when I was standing at the altar, looking at the back of the church, and that door opened, and my bride came out, I think people laughed because I had the biggest, silliest grin on my face. Because there was my bride in all her beauty and glory, dressed and prepared in some ways for me. And that's how God describes his church, his family, heaven. Heaven is not a place, it's a people, it's us. And he says, that, you know, church, you know, church meetings, you know, they all gathered, the meeting was dismissed, and everybody went to the parking lot to say what they really meant. You know, that's, we know church is broken, but here she will be beautiful and glorious and pure. That's not us now, but that will be us. And then John tells us what he hears. And I heard a loud voice from the throne saying, "See, the home of God is among mortals. He will dwell with them. They will be his peoples, and God himself will be with them. He will wipe every tear from their eyes. Death will be no more. Mourning and crying and pain will be no more. For the first things have passed away. God says, why heaven is glorious is not because mom's going to be there, or dad's going to be there, or a brother or sister who died ahead of us is going to be there. As wonderful as that is, why heaven will be glorious is because God will be there. And we will see him not as through a mirror dimly, but face to face. Later on in 21 or 22, John says that there will be no sun or moon needed because God will be the light. The glory of God will brighten that world. I know this is imagery, but it has a point. It makes a point. It's saying something. And not only will God be with us, but that God will comfort us. That every tear will be wiped away. Every sorrow and pain. You know, when you see someone you love racked with pain or racked with cancer or are going losing their mind with Alzheimer's, it's easy to let them go. It's easier to let them go. But God says he's redeeming them and healing them and making them whole again. Verse 5, and the one who was seated on the throne said, see, I am making all things new. Also he said, write this, for these words are trustworthy and true. Then he said to me, it is done. I am the Alpha and the Omega, the beginning and the end. To the thirsty I will give water as a gift from the spring of the water of life. Those who conquer will inherit these things, and I will be their God, and they will be my children. God says, I am making all things new. Not I will, but I am. And that is encouragement for us because God is at work now in us. I think this links up with the Lord's Prayer where we say, thy kingdom come, thy will be done on earth as it is in heaven. God is at work now. He is redeeming us now. I am still broken. Ask anybody who knows me well. Ask anybody who's disagreed with me if I can't say smart alecky things or try and give a put down. Yes, that's me. But thank goodness I'm not as bad as I used to be. You should have seen me years ago. I've said this before, I think. I've said, I thought I had the gift of arguing. If you had an idea, I could tell you what could go wrong with it. I thought that was a gift. It was not. It was a curse. And God is beginning to heal me of that. God is making all things new now. That would have been encouragement to those churches that were struggling with faithfulness, struggling with persecution, struggling with a desire to give up and go home. I think it's important to know that heaven, that the way the story ends, you know, the book of Genesis begins with God making this garden and wanting the man and the woman to live in it and create even better and more beautiful things, to create a beautiful world. And instead they sin and bring destruction and ruin. And here God says, I'm going to do it again and make it right. And it is an encouragement to us to know that God is at work and he is making all things new. It's important for us to remember that God is with us. It's important to remember that he is working even now. But what does this help us with? How do we live in this today? What does it mean that there is a heaven, that we live eternally? Well, part of it, I think, means that you and I don't have to be afraid of death. When my mom was about my age, She was discovered misdiagnosed and finally discovered to have ovarian cancer, stage 4. When the doctor told us that, I went up to the Northside Hospital library and found out what that meant. And that meant she had a 50% 5-year survival rate. And you've met my mom, so you know she's still alive. She made it, but I didn't know that then. And all I could think about was that our 2-year-old Jack would never know my mom the way I knew her. And it grieved me. And then it's as though God spoke to me and said, it's going to be okay. Because the end of her story is not the end of the story. You will see her again. It'll be okay. And it was a great comfort to me. It was. I didn't know whether she was going to live or die. But I felt like God was saying, it's going to be okay. I want to get to that place where I'm okay with life or death. I'm not there yet. I think I'm making strides. As I've met some of you and as a pastor meeting faithful people, I think I've grown in that. But I'm not where Paul was. Paul, in his letter to the Philippians, he's in jail. He's been threatened with death. He thinks he might die. He might be executed in jail. And he's writing to the Philippians and he's saying, I don't know what to pray. I don't know whether to pray to get out of jail and come be your friends and help you again, or to die and be with Christ. I don't know about you, but I think I know how to pray that. I want to get out. I want to live. But I think because Paul had a vision of the glory of God and the future that awaits us, he wasn't afraid of death. You and I don't have to be afraid of death. I have met people who, because of their faith, are not afraid of death. It is a great blessing. But I also think it changes the way our value system. If you buy a refrigerator and think it's going to last a week, say you buy an old one, you're not going to do much to it. You're not going to care for it. You're not going to be real careful. If you spend, I don't know how much they cost, $2,000 on a new refrigerator, and you're wanting it to last 20, 30 years, I think you might, you know, when it says take the filter out, you might want to do that. I think you would. You've made a $2,000 investment. You'll start caring for it. You'll treat it differently from that old refrigerator. If you and I are going to live forever, shouldn't that change what we live for? What is important to us? Randy Alcorn, in one of his books, talks about that, describes it as, live not for the dot, but for the line. A line, imagine a line is, you make a dot, and you draw it, and a line goes on in geometry for eternity. A straight line just keeps going. Do you live for that little dot that's nothing, or do you live for eternity? When we know that we're going to live forever, our values change, and we invest in that which lasts, our character, our choices, our priorities. The reason why we want Kena and the youth to have a space of their own is we say we want to invest, we're going to raise this money to invest it in a place for the youth, because we want to invest in their care, in their spiritual lives. We don't want them to be orphans in our church. We want them to have a home, a place, and we're going to invest in that. We're investing in eternity when we do that. But it also is the idea of heaven is hope. When I went to seminary, the professor, New Testament professor, Gordon Fee, said, in Revelation, it's a hard book to understand, but the big idea is clear. We win. Give me 5. We win. We win. We win. And that gives us hope. When Jack was a little boy, 6 or 8 or 10, we read the Chronicles of Narnia together in bed. It was one of those, you know, dream memories parents have about raising children. We also started Lord of the Rings and got through one book. It's too long. But I hadn't read the Chronicles of Narnia till I was 27, and then I fell in love with them and wanted to read them to him. At the end of the book, the last page of the last book, The Last Battle is the last book. It tells the story of them once again going into Narnia, which is a magical world, and in some ways heaven. And Aslan, the lion, the king of that world, is a figure of Christ. And on that last page, Aslan spoke to the children and said, "You do not yet look so happy as I mean you to be." Lucy said, "We're so afraid of being sent away." "Aslan, you have sent us back into our own world so often." "No fear of that," said Aslan. "Have you not guessed?" Their hearts leapt, and a wild hope rose within them. "There was a real railway accident," Aslan said softly. "Your father and mother and all of you are, as you used to call it in the Shadowlands, this world, dead. The term is over. The holidays have begun. The dream has ended. This is morning." And as he spoke, he no longer looked to them like a lion. But the things that began to happen after that were so great and so beautiful that I cannot write them. And for us, this is the end of all the stories. And we can most truly say that they all lived happily ever after. But for them, it was only the beginning of the real story. All their life in this world and all their adventures in Narnia had only been the cover and the title page. Now at last they were beginning chapter one of the great story, which no one on earth has read, which goes on forever, in which every chapter is better than the one before. Either there is pie in the sky or there's not. And there is, and it makes a difference. And it gives us hope. For All the Saints, it talks about when we go through dark times, we hear that distant strain, the steel, a tune that has gone on forever and will go on forever. We win. God wins. He will see us through.